Bingo, that did it. The independent counsel figured he had caught me in a contradiction. That was sufficient offense for Judge Walsh to write me up in his final report. When that report came out in December 1993, it said that I, too, was privy to detailed information regarding arms shipments to Iran during 1985. Dead wrong. I knew of proposals to ship missiles at that time. I did not know that shipments had actually been made until 1986, after President Reagan signed the finding of necessity authorizing the deal with Iran. Powell's early statements regarding the initiative were forthright and consistent, the report concluded. It went on to say, but some were questionable and seemed generally designed to protect Weinberger. Because independent counsel had no direct evidence that Powell intentionally made false statements, however, these matters were not pursued. I was furious at the implication. I was not judged on whether or not I had actually made false statements. Judge Walsh simply implied that I did and dropped the matter, leaving the unfair and unfounded conclusion. I was not alone. Others received similar unjust treatment. But at least the report ended Iran-Contra for me. The independent counsel, however, was tough on Weinberger. He was indicted, though President Bush pardoned him just before leaving office. Along with many others, I had spoken to the president recommending the pardon. Weinberger was a proud and honorable man. His indictment was a disgrace. This was the man who, from day one, had branded the scheme of arms for hostages as absurd. He fought it every step of the way, and only stopped fighting when President Reagan made the decision to go ahead. Instead of being praised, he was quibbled to death by an out-of-control independent counsel with unlimited time and money at his disposal. The charge against Cap Weinberger was a travesty of justice. Late in May, the family returned to William and Mary for Linda's graduation. On the way home, Linda told us that she was dead serious about an acting career. Linda also screwed up the courage to ask if I would support her through acting school. Much to her astonishment, I am sure, I agreed. But then, what is a father but a banker provided by nature? I returned to my office on the afternoon of June 27, 1987, just as Lieutenant General Andy Chambers, commander of 7th Corps in Germany, phoned me. Mike's been badly hurt, he said, but he's not going to die. Mike and another lieutenant had been riding in a jeep driven by an enlisted man when it went out of control. The other two men had suffered only minor injuries. I would soon be getting a call from the Army Hospital in Nuremberg with details on Mike's condition. Alma was in the kitchen unloading the dishwasher when I arrived. Finally, the call came from the hospital. Mike had suffered a broken pelvis and serious internal injuries. His condition was critical. Within 4 days of the accident, Mike was in Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington. There he was examined by Dr. Bruce Van Dam, one of the best orthopedic surgeons in the military, and perhaps one of the finest in the country. As he was leaving, Dr. Van Dam said to Mike, "You know your military career is over, don't you?" Mike had not known, or had blotted it out of his thoughts. For the next 6 months, Alma's life and mine centered on the hospital. Our son was on the mend, partly through excellent medical care, but as much because of some unbreakable fiber within him in which we took enormous pride. In early November, Cap Weinberger informed the president that he intended to resign as Secretary of Defense. The secretary had spent 7 grueling years on the job. The search for a new secretary was short. The call went out once again to Frank Carlucci. With Carlucci going to the Pentagon, I saw an opening for me to try to return to the Army. That is, until Chief of Staff Howard Baker cornered me one morning and led me into his office. "If we offered you National Security Advisor to the President, would you say no?" "Howard, after Poindexter, you can't possibly put another active-duty officer in as head of the NSC. You'll be crucified." "The President can appoint anybody he wants," Baker said. "What I'm asking is, what will you say?" It is not easy to say no to a president, and I had probably played out all my Army options by now anyway. "If offered, I would accept," I said. On November 5, 1987, a sunlit day with a hint of autumn crispness in the air, we filed into the Rose Garden. The President expressed the nation's gratitude to Cap Weinberger, and he then announced that Lieutenant General Colonel Powell would succeed Frank Carlucci as the President's National Security Advisor. Alma and my daughters were there, but what brought the mist to my eyes was the presence of my son, who had gotten out of a hospital bed, put on a suit, and stood with the aid of crutches for the first time since his accident. In December, Mikhail Gorbachev came to Washington for his third summit meeting with President Reagan, and they signed the treaty to eliminate intermediate-range nuclear force missiles. For the first time in the 40 years of their existence, nuclear weapons were being dismantled. In January 1988, we entered the last year of the Reagan administration, and I spent much of my time planning for the upcoming Moscow summit in May. In February, I flew with Secretary of State George Shultz to Moscow. There I met with a figure right out of Cold War history, Anatoly Dobrynin, Soviet ambassador to the United States in the eras of Khrushchev, Brezhnev, Andropov, and Chernenko. Dobrynin must have been made of cork. He had survived all these hard-line communist regimes and was still a senior advisor to Mikhail Gorbachev in the era of glasnost and perestroika. We had spent the day working on the upcoming summit when Dobrynin sidled up to me and said he thought we ought to have a little chat over dinner, just the two of us. His driver took us in a Zill limousine to a massive grand hotel. Dobrynin had a big, open, avuncular face and a disarming manner. I was on my guard. "Colin," he said as we ate, "you must understand what's going on here. Gorbachev is trying to make this a nation of laws instead of a place run by party hacks." He went on to point out that the new leader's approach to the military was unprecedented. "He's driving the generals crazy. Gorbachev says, 'Why do you tell me we have to have this weapon or that weapon just because the Americans have it? I'm not out to conquer the Americans.'" What Gorbachev wanted, Dobrynin continued, was to fix the Soviet Union at home. The new regime wanted to move toward free markets, but the switch was not easy. I knew I was listening to an old pro, a diplomat as smooth as pre-revolutionary silk. Still, I did not automatically discount what Anatoly Dobrynin told me. I went back to my hotel and wrote down every word I could remember. In April, President Reagan was to deliver a speech to the World Affairs Council of Western Massachusetts. Reagan wanted to continue moving away from confrontation and toward cooperation with the Soviet Union. But behaving like a pushover is not a good bargaining tactic. Furthermore, this was an election year. Reagan would not be running himself, but the administration was determined to hold on to its conservative base and hand it to the next Republican candidate. The speech, consequently, had been written as an old-fashioned West versus East stemwinder. I was a shade apprehensive about the diplomacy of it, but from a hard-nosed political standpoint, I reckoned the strategy made sense. On April 22nd, the day after the president delivered the speech, I was with George Shultz in the Kremlin. Across the table from us sat Mikhail Gorbachev, face grim, voice tight, hand chopping the air, condemning the tough speech. The dressing down went on for a full 45 minutes. I began to sense that Gorbachev was playing to his own constituencies represented by the Soviets around the table. He could not let his nation be pummeled without appearing to strike back. Shultz wisely ignored the browbeating, and when Gorbachev stopped at last, proceeded calmly to the agenda. Gorbachev's tone changed. The Russian began describing his objectives under perestroika and glasnost. He was going to change the Communist Party. He was going to change the USSR in ways we never imagined. He was saying, in effect, that he was ending the Cold War. The battle between their ideology and ours was over, and they had lost. He looked directly at me, knowing I was a military man, and said with a twinkling eye, "What are you going to do now that you've lost your best enemy?" One weekend in July, my son Mike came to my office with a surprise. He was going to marry a young woman named Jane Knott, whom Alma and I knew and liked very much. Nevertheless, our reaction was mixed. On the one hand, this development marked Mike's continuing recovery. Mike had gone to work in the Pentagon as a specialist in Japanese affairs. On the other, the idea of an interracial marriage made Alma and me uneasy, despite the happy marriage of my sister to Norm Burns. I stressed the word uneasy. We were not opposed. The older generation knows what the younger generation may still have to learn. Making a marriage work is tough enough even under ordinary conditions. You do not need to make it tougher. They were married in October. That summer, the Army and the Navy were in a battle royal. U.S. military forces are divided into 10 major commands led by CINCS, which stands for Commander-in-Chief. One such commander, the CINC for CENTCOM, was about to retire. CENTCOM, Central Command, covered the Middle East and Southwest Asia. The Persian Gulf nations, however, did not want American bases on their soil. Consequently, CENTCOM was headquartered at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida and able to call on U.S. units all over the world. Choosing the right CINC for CENTCOM was critical. If you had to put your finger on the hottest part of the globe, it would likely come down in CENTCOM's domain. The Navy, since it now had forces in the Gulf escorting reflagged Kuwaiti tankers, thought it was high time a Navy admiral commanded CENTCOM. The Joint Chiefs of Staff were split down the middle. The Army and Air Force wanted an Army man, and the Navy and Marines wanted an admiral. The chairman, Admiral Crowe, broke the tie 3-2, voting for the Navy man. The decision was now in the hands of the Secretary of Defense, Frank Carlucci. The Army's candidate was General H. Norman Schwarzkopf, 55, a burly, brilliant, volatile, 6'3" bear of a man, whom I had first come to know a few years before as a Fort Myer neighbor. We had never served together, and were not close, but I knew his reputation as a superb troop leader. I was also aware of both the brilliance and the explosiveness that produced the apt nickname Stormin' Norman. As National Security Advisor, I was not formally in the personnel assignment loop, yet I had strong opinions about who should get CENTCOM. CENTCOM had been designed as a rapid deployment task force to fight land battles in the desert region. The job clearly belonged to a soldier or marine, not a sailor. I made my strong preference known to Carlucci. Frank himself was not keen on having an admiral in CENTCOM and overruled the JCS recommendation, and that is how Norm Schwarzkopf came to obtain the command that would propel him into history. On November 9, 1988, the day after the presidential election, the White House staff held a simple ceremony in the Rose Garden to welcome the victorious George Bush back from the campaign trail. Afterward, Bush asked me to his office. "Let's chat for a bit. I need an update on what's been happening." I gave him a quick survey of the international scene. When I finished, he said, "You're one of the few people in the White House I want to consider for the new team. I have some options I hope you'll think about. Jim Baker would like you as Deputy Secretary of State. Or you can have the CIA. Or you can stay on as National Security Advisor for a while until you decide what you want to do. Take some time. Think it over." That night I stopped by Carl Vono's house at Fort Myer. Carl was now Army Chief of Staff. "Carl, I've been away for a while, but what I really want to do is stay in the Army, if there's a job for me." Carl is a no-nonsense guy and came right to the point. "Forget this business about being away too long," he said. In fact, he had a job for me. Commander-in-Chief of Forces Command, ForceCom, responsible for all Army field forces based in the United States, almost 1 million troops, including National Guard and Reserve units. After mulling the matter over for a couple of days, I went in and told Vice President Bush that I wanted to return to the Army, a decision which he accepted graciously. Immediately afterward, at our regular morning briefing, I told President Reagan what I had decided. "ForceCom is 4 stars, isn't it?" he asked. "Yes," I answered, "the Army's highest rank." "Good. Good," he said. The man who had done so much to shape my life, Frank Carlucci, and so much to save the Reagan-Bush presidency by rehabilitating the NSC after Iran-Contra, was leaving too. In the final weeks of the Reagan administration, I could feel the pressure subside. I had just completed the most crowded, momentous year of my life. I had taken part in the historic turning point in the second half of this century, the seismic changes occurring in the Soviet Union. I had worked closely with major world figures, and I had helped shape the Reagan policies that reversed the race toward nuclear Armageddon. The best part for me had been working directly with Ronald Reagan. He may not have commanded every detail of every policy, but he had others to do that. The editor and author Michael Korda once wrote a perceptive definition. "Great leaders are almost always great simplifiers, who cut through argument, debate, and doubt to offer a solution everybody can understand." That description fit Ronald Reagan. The man had been elected president twice by knowing what the American people wanted, and even rarer, by giving it to them. As commander of ForceCom, I now had under me a quarter of a million active duty troops and another quarter million reservists, and I presided over the training of 500,000 National Guard soldiers. We had a well-trained and well-equipped force in a high state of combat readiness. But to fight whom and where? With the Cold War fast thawing, I found our commanders still fixated on a battle between us and the Soviet Union. Some of my fellow officers foresaw the need to change course. Army Chief of Staff Carl Vono was anticipating the tough transition from the fat budgets of the past to the inevitable shrinking funds for the military in the future. I decided to use the pulpit of ForceCom to deliver a dose of reality regarding the necessary downsizing of the military. In peacetime, when a command is well-run, the commanding officer has frankly a picnic compared to the dawn-to-dusk pressures of a place like the NSC. At ForceCom, I had good people working for me. Once again, I could lead the good life. I had a fine Victorian mansion and time for Alma and me to enjoy our new status as grandparents. Jeffrey Michael Powell had been born to Jane and Mike just before our move to Atlanta. One day in early summer, I got word that Dick Cheney, the new Secretary of Defense, wanted to see me. Cheney had not yet been to ForceCom, he said, and wanted to stop by to be briefed on his way back to Washington. I was fairly sure Cheney had not stopped in Atlanta only for a briefing on ForceCom training, but he gave no hint of any other reason why he might have come. In August, I got a message from Cheney. Would I come to the Pentagon right away? Cheney greeted me with a smile. In September, Admiral Bill Crowe's second term as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff would end. Crowe was offered another two-year term, but he declined. Cheney asked me how I felt about the job. Of course, I'm flattered, I said. And obviously, if you and the president want me, I'll take it and do my best. Unspoken was my genuine concern. This would be a tough assignment. I was junior to every one of the 15 four-stars legally eligible for the chairmanship. My fourth star had been on my shoulder for barely 4 months. The president wonders if your appointment would be a problem for the other senior generals and admirals, Cheney asked. I knew I could count on Vono's support, and I had good relations with the other service chiefs. I'm not worried about that, I said. Never let him see you sweat. 3 days after the announcement of my nomination as chairman, I was yanked back suddenly and sadly to the roots of my calling. Ronnie Brooks, my model, mentor, and inspiration during the days of the CCNY Pershing Rifles, had died of a massive heart attack at the age of 54. I flew to Albany, New York, and spoke at Ronnie's funeral, praising this good man. I could not help being struck by the randomness of life. Had I never met the inspiring Brooks, the perfect cadet who preferred to become a civilian chemical engineer, would my life have taken the course that it did? The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as principal military advisor, gives his own counsel directly to the President, the Secretary of Defense, and the members of the National Security Council. The chairman was not in the chain of command, but the Secretary of Defense could require that military orders go through him to the field commanders, which Cheney had done. On that first day in my new office, I placed on my desk the marble set with the Schaefer pens that I had won at Fort Bragg in 1957 for being best cadet, Company D. That afternoon, Alma and I went to a family party in Washington thrown by my cousin, Arthur Sonny Lewis, an extraordinary man who had gone from a Navy enlisted career to ambassador to Sierra Leone. All the fun and warmth of my Jamaican boyhood came flooding back, and the party went on to the last tot of rum. I had been chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff just over 24 hours and was sound asleep in my residence at Fort Myer when the phone woke me at 2:38 a.m. The Joint Staff Operations Officer, Lieutenant General Tom Kelly, was on the line, alerting me to a coup said to be brewing against the Noriega regime in Panama. I could expect a call in a few minutes, Tom Kelly told me, from General Max Thurman, who had just taken over in Panama as 6th Southcom, Commander-in-Chief of the Southern Command. Max was a legend, considered one of the smartest, toughest officers in the Army. I had thought all along that if we ever did get involved in Panama, dumping Noriega would not end the problem. His power base was the Panama Defense Force, the PDF. When we got rid of Noriega, another PDF goon would rise up to take his place. Noriega had stopped the elections of May 1989, when his opponent, Guillermo Endara, seemed to be winning, and Noriega had his PDF toughs beat up Endara's vice presidential candidate, in full view of American TV cameras. I asked Max to keep me informed and then phoned Secretary Cheney. This was a key call, the first time I would be carrying out the JCS chairman's responsibility to provide military advice to the Secretary of Defense. The coup took place the following morning, but by early afternoon it had collapsed. Thurman and I received quite a baptism. We compared notes and determined that if we were ever forced to act in Panama, we would favor getting rid of the entire PDF. Max began to develop a plan to do just that. Over the next 2 months, rumors of more coups floated out of Panama. An existing plan, codenamed Blue Spoon, was beefed up to include taking out the PDF as well as removing Noriega. On Saturday evening, December 16, 1989, I got another call from Tom Kelly. "Mr. Chairman, we've got a problem." The first details were sketchy. I learned only that a U.S. Marine, Lieutenant Robert Paz, had been shot in Panama. The situation grew worse as the night wore on. A Navy officer and his wife, who had witnessed the shooting, were detained by the PDF and taken to a police station for interrogation. Lieutenant Curtis was roughed up and threatened with death. Mrs. Curtis was forced to stand against a wall while PDF soldiers pawed her until she collapsed. I reported all this to Cheney, and we considered whether we had an unignorable provocation. "Max and I both believe we've got to protect American citizens," I said. "Besides, Noriega's not a legitimate leader. He's a criminal. He's under indictment." It was a strange time to plan for war. Sunday afternoon, December 17th, I was hurrying down a festively decked corridor of the White House, then up to the Bush's private apartment on the second floor. The president had called in Dick Cheney, Jim Baker, Secretary of State, Brent Scowcroft, the National Security Advisor, Bob Gates, his deputy, and Marlon Fitzwater, the press secretary. I began to brief. We were going to eliminate Noriega and the PDF. If that succeeded, we would be running the country until we could establish a civilian government and a new security force. We would use the forces in place, 13,000 troops. That number, however, was not enough. Army Rangers would parachute onto the main barracks at Rio Hato, west of Panama City, and take out the PDF companies used to put down past coups. Our Air Force's new F-117A stealth fighter would be employed for the first time in combat to support the Rangers. Paratroopers of the 82nd Airborne Division would drop on objectives east of the city. More troops from the 7th Infantry Division would be flown in from Fort Ord, California, to extend our control of the country and to help restore law and order. Navy SEALs would take the airfield. The Blue Spoon Joint Task Force, commanded by Lieutenant General Carl Steiner, would total over 20,000 troops. I predicted that within hours of H-hour, Noriega, captured or not, would no longer be in power, and we would have created conditions that would allow the elected Endara government to come out of hiding and take office. I finished my briefing pointing out that the Joint Chiefs agreed to the plan. Then the questions began flying. George Bush sat like a patron on a bar stool, coolly observing a brawl while his advisers went hard at it. Brent Scowcroft said, "There are going to be casualties. People are going to die." The president nodded and let the debate roll on. "When will we be ready to go?" the president finally asked. "In 2.5 days," I said. After everyone had had his say, Bush gripped the arms of his chair and rose. "Okay, let's do it," he said. "The hell with it." In one of my several phone conversations with Max Thurman, I mentioned that Blue Spoon might be fine as a code name, but it was hardly a rousing call to arms. You do not risk people's lives for blue spoons. We kicked around a number of ideas and finally settled on Max's suggestion, Just Cause. Along with the inspirational ring, I liked something else about it. Even our severest critics would have to utter Just Cause while denouncing us. The last night before the invasion, sitting alone in the dark in the back seat of my car on the drive home, I felt full of foreboding. I was going to be involved in conducting a war, one that I had urged, one that was sure to spill blood. Had I been right? I went to bed gnawed by self-doubt. On Tuesday morning, December 19, my confidence came surging back, my worries vanished, and I entered the calm before the storm. At 11:30 p.m., I joined Dick Cheney in the National Military Command Center, a maze of rooms jammed with computers, maps, radios, and telephones, and action officers scurrying all over the place. Tom Kelly had recently carved out a crisis room in the middle of this jumble for me, my principal staff officers, and for the Secretary of Defense. We sat there at a table with two large television monitors in front of us, on which to receive situation reports from Panama. Behind us were telephones providing direct secure lines to Thurman and his staff. Almost every report coming into the crisis center corrected the previous report. Combat, especially night fighting, is organized confusion. At 7:40 the next morning, the president went on television to explain to the American people why we had invaded Panama. The cameras then shifted to the Pentagon, where Cheney spoke first, and then it was my turn. I explained every detail down to the last platoon assault. I reminded the audience that this was an ongoing campaign. Most of our objectives had been taken, but we expected continued resistance from PDF remnants and paramilitary units armed by Noriega. So far, we had only lost 4 soldiers, but we should expect more casualties. My intention was to convey a sense of calm and confidence that we knew what we were doing. By the next day, most of the fighting was over. President Endara had been sworn in and was now in the presidential palace. 24 Americans gave their lives in Panama to achieve this victory for democracy. Our press arrangements produced recriminations on both sides. We were slow in getting the press pool to Panama and to the action. Consequently, the press ate us alive with some justification. Yet things had happened on the press side during Just Cause that tested to the limit my customary support of the media. On the second day of the invasion, I watched President Bush during a televised press conference. He was visibly upbeat after the quick success of Just Cause. The president could not know that as he was giving occasionally smiling answers to reporters, the networks were simultaneously showing on split screens a transport plane unloading the bodies of the first American casualties. Sensational images, but cheap shot journalism. I was angered when the press started trying to direct the war as well as cover it. Near the center of Panama City stood a radio tower. Every armchair strategist knows that you have to knock out the enemy's capacity to communicate. The White House started taking flack from the press, and I started taking flack from Brent Scowcroft, the National Security Advisor. I told him that the tower was not bothering us and we did not yet have the troops in that part of town to take it. We did not want to knock the tower down anyway, because President Endara would need it in a day or so. No dice. The press heat was too great, and the tower had to go. It was a pointless objective. Then I got another call from Brent Scowcroft telling me that several correspondents were trapped in the Marriott Hotel in Panama City. We've got to rescue them. They're in no danger, I said. The fighting will soon sweep right past them. I then got a call from Dick Cheney. Do it, he said. No more arguments. I reluctantly called General Thurman. I told Cheney that I did not want to pass along any more such orders. If the press has to cover a war, there's no way we can eliminate the risks of war. This was a new, tough age for the military, fighting a war as it was being reported. We could not, in a country pledged to free expression, simply turn off the press. But we were going to have to find a way to live with this unprecedented situation. A CBS poll conducted soon after the installation of President Endara showed that 9 out of 10 Panamanians favored the U.S. intervention. The lessons I absorbed from Panama confirmed all my convictions over the preceding 20 years, since the days of doubt over Vietnam. Have a clear political objective and stick to it. Use all the force necessary, and do not apologize for going in big if that is what it takes. Decisive force ends wars quickly and in the long run saves lives. Now, almost 6 years after Just Cause, Mr. Noriega, convicted on drug charges, sits in an American prison cell, and the country of Panama is still a democracy with one free election to its credit. I started to crystallize what I really wanted to accomplish as chairman. My thoughts were guided simply by what I had observed at world summits, by my experience at the National Security Council, by what I like to think of as informed intuition. I was going to project what I expected to happen over the next 5 years and try to design an Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps to match these expectations. I wrote at the top of the pad, Strategic Overview, 1994. I wrote down what I foresaw in the Soviet Union, the rise of opposition parties, Western investment, market pricing, and, you can't win them all, Gorbachev still in supreme authority. I predicted Soviet military budget cuts of 40% and manpower cuts of 50%, and then I really stuck my neck out. By 1994, no Soviet forces in Eastern Europe. Warsaw Pact replaced. East Germany gone. All Eastern Bloc countries, neutral states with multi-party systems. I also wrote regarding Germany, reunified, and Berlin undivided. In South Africa, I anticipated a black majority government, and in Latin America, Cuba isolated, irrelevant. Of course, trouble spots would persist, and I identified them as Korea, Lebanon, the Persian Gulf, Philippines. I made another heading, potential U.S. involvement, and under it listed two places, Korea and the Persian Gulf. I began matching these projections to a commensurate strength and structure for the U.S. military. And here, going almost entirely on gut feelings, I wrote, from a 550-ship to a 450-ship Navy, reduce our Army strength in Europe from 300,000 to between 75 and 100,000, and cut back the active-duty Army from 760,000 to 525,000. The Marines, the Air Force, and the Reserves would be cut as well. These levels would be tough to sell to Cheney, but he was also savvy, and not long out of Congress, where he had sensed the mounting political pressure to cut back on defense spending and declare a peace dividend. Back on November 10, 1989, the most brutal symbol of communist oppression, the Berlin Wall, had cracked open with the East German government's acquiescence. On November 14th, I took a deep breath and submitted my strategic overview to Secretary Cheney. Since the president was about to embark on a summit with Gorbachev at Malta within days, Cheney and I recommended to him that he let Gorbachev know the changes we were contemplating. In return, he should press Gorbachev to withdraw Soviet troops from Eastern Europe rapidly and bring them home where they would not present an offensive threat. I did not have to wait long before events vindicated my prediction of trouble spots. In late November 1989, right before Just Cause, we had to respond to a coup against President Corazon Aquino of the Philippines. I went immediately to the National Military Command Center in the Pentagon, arriving just after 11 p.m. I sat at a table facing five television monitors. On one, I could see the White House Situation Room with Vice President Quayle at the center of the table. Quayle was there because President Bush was in the air, flying to Malta for his meeting with Gorbachev. The face of Larry Eagleburger, the Deputy Secretary of State, filled a second screen. On a third was Bill Webster, the CIA director, and on a fourth, Harry Rowan, Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. With me, by pure chance, was the sink for all of our forces in the Pacific, Admiral Huntington Hunt Hardesty. He had come to the Pentagon for budget talks. President Corazon Aquino, I was informed, had reported that the presidential palace in Manila was being bombed and strafed by rebel planes. She had requested U.S. military intervention to stop the attacks. Eagleburger argued hard in favor of answering Aquino's appeal. "We sponsored this democratic government," he said. Our ambassador in Manila, Nicholas Platt, reconfirmed an official request that we bomb an airfield under rebel control. Mothy old T-28s, World War II prop-driven trainers, based at this field, were the planes attacking the capital. Before we did anything rash, we needed more on-site information. I wanted to talk to Fidel Ramos, the Philippine defense minister, to get an eyeball account. While waiting to reach him, I described to Quayle and the others a plan that Hardesty and I had devised. Have our F-4 Phantom jets stationed at Clark Air Force Base buzz any T-28s daring to come onto the runway at the rebel-held airbase. In short, scare hell out of them. If any of these planes started to take off, fire in front of them, and if any took off, shoot them down. I called Cheney, who agreed. He contacted Air Force One and called me back within 10 minutes to tell me we had the president's approval. Go, Cheney said. While all this was happening, Dan Quayle had also called the president's plane, and just as I was about to have Hardesty transmit the order for the F-4s to take to the air, the White House Chief of Staff's deputy came up on the screen and said, "Hold up, the vice president is getting instructions from Air Force One." This was sloppy crisis management. On my screen, I saw Quayle come back into the Situation Room, wearing a rather blank expression. I've talked to the president, was all he said. Does that mean we can go? I asked. Oh, he replied. I thought you were already ahead. I turned to Admiral Hardesty and gave him the go order. The F-4s were launched. They buzzed the airfield repeatedly, and no Filipino pilot took off to see what would happen next. Finally, we reached Fidel Ramos. He told me the situation was dicey but under control. Bombing? Who was asking us to bomb anything? Don't bomb, we were told. Within hours, the coup collapsed without our getting further involved and without the F-4s shooting up anybody or anything. A few days later, General Abanina, the coup leader, said, "We were about to take over the government. Then the United States warplanes appeared. We simply cannot hope to win against the stronger power of the United States Air Force." The night the coup ended, I left the Pentagon feeling good. I had applied my own rule in forming military advice. Take no action until you have a clear objective. We had applied restrained, proportionate, calibrated force linked to a specific goal, and it had worked. A few days later, Dick Cheney said, "That went reasonably well," referring to the Philippine episode. "But don't worry, you will never be put in that situation again. You can be sure of that." With the Philippine issue resolved and just cause ended in Panama, I could get back to redesigning the armed forces.
Praise the Lord, a long shot was coming in. Not that Alma and I ever doubted the talent of our daughter Linda. Here we were, on a March evening, all dressed up, headed to watch Linda performing with a road company in Play to Win, the story of Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier in baseball. Linda had a lead as Jackie's wife. She was marvelous, and she was getting paid. 7 years had passed since I started the campaign to erect a statue at Fort Leavenworth to honor the Buffalo Soldiers. I had passed the torch to Alonzo Daugherty, and Lonnie did what he could, but without much support. And then Commander Carlton Philpott, a black naval officer, reported to Leavenworth and became enthralled with the Buffalo Soldiers project. Philpott was not content with a statue of a soldier on horseback. He wanted a park with a reflecting pool and the statue. How much money would his plan take, I asked. $500,000, he said. I gagged, but agreed to see what I could do. I became a part-time fundraiser. August 1, 1990 began conventionally enough. This was, however, to be no ordinary day. In one respect, it should have been triumphant. For the previous 8 months, I had been shepherding the base force proposal through the bureaucratic maze. The president was going to Aspen, Colorado the next day, where he would meet with British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and give a speech announcing the base force as the new shape of America's armed forces. The changes envisioned were enormous, from a total active duty strength of 2.1 million down to 1.6 million. The plan the president was going to propose would effectively mark the end of a 40-year-old strategy of communist containment, a strategy that had succeeded. We had won. Also this day, I had asked Norm Schwarzkopf to come up from CENTCOM headquarters to brief the chiefs and Cheney on alarming rumbles along the Iraq-Kuwait border. I was home by 7 p.m. for dinner. A few minutes before 8 p.m., the secure phone rang, rarely the harbinger of good news. Saddam Hussein had just sent the Iraqi army across the border into Kuwait. The Iraqi army had made me uncomfortable ever since Iraq and Iran ended their bloody 8-year war in 1988. Once Saddam, with an army over 1 million men strong, no longer had Iran to worry about, I feared he would look for mischief somewhere else. Iraq was nearly $90 billion in debt after the war. As a proportion of its gross national product, it was a sum that made the U.S. deficit look prudent. Saddam blamed Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates for preventing Iraq from working its way out of this Grand Canyon of a hole. They had thrust a poisoned dagger into Iraq's back by busting the oil quotas set by OPEC, thus driving prices down and reducing Iraq's income. Kuwait, Saddam further charged, had siphoned off $2.5 billion in oil from the Rumaila oil field which the two countries shared, and he covetously eyed two Kuwaiti-held islands, Warba and Bubiyan, which blocked his access to the Gulf. If the United States got involved militarily in the Persian Gulf, it would be in Norm's court. We discussed the continuing Iraqi buildup, by now 4 divisions and over 100,000 troops. Arab leaders kept telling us not to worry. Arab brothers did not war against each other. Military men looked for 3 surefire clues that an enemy force is preparing to attack. Is it moving its artillery forward? Is it laying down communications? Is it reinforcing its forces logistically with stocks of fuel and ammunition? By July 31st, all three conditions were present in southern Iraq. At the August 1st meeting with the chiefs and Cheney, Norm gave a sobering 90-minute survey. "What do you think they'll do?" Cheney asked. "I think they're going to attack," Norm said. He thought it would be a limited attack to seize the Kuwaiti part of the Rumaila oil field and Bubiyan Island. The Bush administration, however, seemed intent on keeping out of inter-Arab squabbles. During a meeting with Saddam Hussein 5 days earlier, our ambassador to Iraq, April Glaspie, told him, "We have no opinion on Arab-Arab conflicts like your border disagreement with Kuwait. We had Arab states saying nothing was going to happen, and the United States saying that if anything did, it was not our concern." After Schwarzkopf's briefing, as Cheney and I were leaving, I said, "Dick, this is serious. We can't ignore what's going on. I think the president should get off a tough message to Saddam today." But it was too late. Before we could fire a diplomatic warning shot, 80,000 of Saddam's Republican guards were across the border, rolling toward Kuwait City. On Friday, the president called the National Security Council together in the cabinet room. "Mrs. Thatcher and I see eye to eye," he said. "I expect we can get our friends to support joint political and economic action in the Gulf." He was particularly pleased that one old mold appeared to have been broken. The day before, the United Nations Security Council had voted 14-0 to condemn the invasion and demand immediate and unconditional Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait, and the yay votes included the Soviet Union. Bill Webster, the CIA director, gave us a bleak status report. The Iraqis are within 0.8 of a mile of the Saudi border. If Saddam stays where he is, he'll own 20% of the world's oil reserves. And a few miles away, he can seize another 20%. He'll have easy access to the sea from Kuwaiti ports. Jordan and Yemen will probably tilt toward him, and he'll be in a position to extort the others. We can expect the Arab states to start cutting deals. Iran will be at Iraq's feet. Israel will be threatened. Saddam Hussein, Webster concluded, would become the preeminent figure in the Persian Gulf. "We've got to make a response," Brent Scowcroft said, "and accommodating Saddam is not an option." Larry Eagleburger, Deputy Secretary of State, urged, "We ought to go for a Chapter 7 from the United Nations, which would authorize military force and economic sanctions." The next day, Saturday, Norm Schwarzkopf, I, and Dick Cheney met with President Bush and the rest of his national security team at Camp David. Norm went over the military options and made it clear to the president that to defend Saudi Arabia and eventually to eject the Iraqi army out of Kuwait would take a massive military force. The following day, Sunday, President Bush came down from Camp David and, when asked about the situation, uttered the words, "This will not stand," meaning the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait would not stand. At 3:30 p.m. on Monday, August 6th, Dick Cheney called me from Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. He had just left King Fahd. "We've got his approval. I've informed the president. Start issuing orders to move the force." We had just been given permission to land our troops in Saudi Arabia. We had already alerted the 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, 3rd Army Headquarters in Atlanta, and the 1st Tactical Fighter Wing at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia. But not one paratrooper was going anywhere until he could be airlifted by MAC, the Military Airlift Command, the Armed Forces Federal Express. MAC would hire dozens of commercial air charters to round out the airlift. A winged armada was about to fill the skies over the Atlantic. We knew from CIA estimates that the Iraqis had at least 1,000 tons of chemical agents. We knew that Saddam had used both mustard and nerve gases in his war against Iran. The Iraqi chemical threat was manageable. Our troops had protective suits and detection and alarm systems. What to do about Iraq's biological weapons, however, remained a more troubling question. The operation in the Gulf now had a name. Norm Schwarzkopf's staff and mine had kicked around a number of ideas. Finally, we settled on a name we all thought had just the right ring, Desert Shield. As we started to develop an offensive option alongside this defensive stance, Norm and I talked about how to differentiate the two. Norm suggested Desert Storm. Stormin' Norman Storm. It was a natural, and we all went for it. Schwarzkopf had by now set up headquarters in the Ministry of Defense building in Riyadh, the Saudi Arabian capital. By early September, the buildup was starting to reach mammoth proportions. Tens of thousands of troops were already in the Gulf region or on the way, streaming to airports and seaports all over the United States. The president had authorized the call-up of up to 200,000 reservists and guardsmen, and many volunteered even before the call. We could not have gone to war without the reserves, and they were to perform superbly. In September, I stepped out of an Air Force 707 at the Riyadh airport and felt as if I had entered a blast furnace. Norm had been in Saudi Arabia only a couple of weeks when I arrived. He now had the weight of the world on his shoulders, and it showed. At this early stage, morale among our troops was high, but the desert was a bleak, forbidding world. I witnessed the beginnings of a formidable force gathering as our allies started to arrive, the British first. The Gulf States committed forces, along with France, Canada, Italy, Egypt, Syria, and others, eventually totaling 28 nations. Countries unable to contribute troops helped finance the buildup. We had been planning for this kind of war on a grand scale for years at NATO. But we had assumed it would be fought amid hills and forest against the Soviet enemy, not across sand dunes against an Arab foe. Leading such a diverse force presented a challenge not unlike that which General Eisenhower faced as Supreme Allied Commander in Europe during World War II. Very possibly, Norm Schwarzkopf's greatest single achievement was his extraordinary ability to weld this babel of armies into one fighting force without offending dozens of heads of state. On September 24th, I went to Dick Cheney's office. "Dick," I said, "the president's really getting impatient. He keeps asking if we can't get the Iraqis out of Kuwait with airstrikes." "Yes," Cheney said, "he's concerned that time is running out on him." George Bush was investing enormous political capital in Desert Shield. His administration had come almost to a domestic standstill as the Gulf swallowed up his attention, and he did not think he could hold the international coalition together indefinitely. "You know how Norm, the chiefs, and I feel," I said to Cheney. "We shouldn't go on the offensive until we have a force in place that can guarantee victory, and that's going to take time." "So what do you want to do?" Cheney asked. "I think we owe him a more complete description of how long-term sanctions and strangulation would work." When we arrived at the White House, the president was seated at his desk talking with Scowcroft and Chief of Staff John Sununu. "Mr. President," Cheney said, "the chairman has some thoughts for you." The president nodded for me to proceed. "Sir," I began, "you still have two basic options available. The first is the offensive option." I walked him through the mobilization schedule. I also explained an air option we had in place should Saddam attempt another provocation requiring our instant response. "I still recommend that we continue preparing for a full-scale air, land, and sea campaign. If you decide to go that route in October, we'll be ready to launch sometime in January." But there was still the other option, sanctions. Even if we built up to an offensive force, we could always ratchet it back down to a defensive level. Restraining Iraq from further aggression through our defensive strategy and strangling her into withdrawal through sanctions remained a live option. "Of course, there's a serious disadvantage," I conceded. "Sanctions left the initiative with the Iraqis to decide when they had had enough." When I finished, he said, "Thanks, Colin, that's useful. That's very interesting. It's good to consider all the angles, but I really don't think we have time for sanctions to work." With that, the meeting ended. In his book, The Commanders, Bob Woodward paints a dramatic picture of this scene. He has me wanting to steer the president toward a less aggressive course in the Gulf, but fearful to press my point hard enough because none of the other advisers present backed me. After his book came out, there was a lot of talk about Powell, the reluctant warrior. Guilty. War is a deadly game, and I do not believe in spending the lives of Americans lightly. My responsibility that day was to lay out all options for the nation's civilian leadership. On October 22nd, I was in the Saudi Ministry of Defense, sitting in Schwarzkopf's war room 5 stories below ground. We talked about how we might better exploit the enemy's static position. The Iraqi army was just sitting there in Kuwait. The sea was to the east. Their own fortifications were to their south. In effect, they had trapped themselves. We talked about slamming the doors shut on the west and the north and cutting off their lines of support. "We can use a heavy armored corps to roll fast and deep around the western flank," I said, "and we can send the 18th Airborne Corps north to block the Euphrates River Valley and cut off their lines of reinforcement and withdrawal." The Iraqis' disposition of forces practically wrote the plan for us. I asked Norm what additional forces this expanded strategy would require. He repeated a previous request for a two-division corps from Europe. I agreed and said that we would add a third division from the United States. We would also send another Marine division. I beefed up his request for additional fighter squadrons. Aircraft carriers? Let's send six. We had paid for this stuff. Why not use it? What were we saving it for? We had learned a lesson in Panama. Go in big and end it quickly. We could not put the United States through another Vietnam. We could be so lavish with resources because the world had changed. We could now afford to pull divisions out of Germany, divisions that had been there for the past 40 years to stop a Soviet offensive that was no longer coming. Norm, I said, you've got to understand that the President and Cheney will give you anything you need to get the job done. And don't worry, you won't be jumping off until you're ready. We're not going off half-cocked. As I spoke, I saw the tension flow out of Schwarzkopf for the first time since I had arrived. As he later described this moment, I felt as though Powell had lifted a great load from my shoulders, and I went back to Washington feeling better than I had in weeks. On November 29th, the United Nations was scheduled to vote whether or not to sanction military force to get Iraq out of Kuwait. The UN approval capped an extraordinary feat of diplomacy in this century, and the lion's share of the credit for this triumph belongs to George Bush, superbly aided by Secretary of State Jim Baker. By the time Resolution 678 was passed, a remarkable coalition had been welded together, mostly over the phone from the Oval Office. The UN resolution also set limits on the coalition, which was only to free Kuwait. However much we despised Saddam and what he had done, the United States had little desire to shatter his country. For the previous 10 years, Iran, not Iraq, had been our Middle East nemesis. We wanted Iraq to continue as a threat and as a counterweight to Iran. We hoped that Saddam would not survive the coming fury, but his elimination was not a stated objective. What we hoped for, frankly, in a post-war Gulf region, was an Iraq still standing, with Saddam overthrown. The UN had given us our marching orders, and the President intended to stay within them. I was amazed, given the forces and power now arrayed against Saddam Hussein, unmatched since D-Day, that he still had not blinked. He had passed the sanctions exit. The President's instincts had been right from the start. Sanctions would not work. I still believe that sanctions are a useful weapon in the armory of nations. They help, for example, to hasten the meltdown of apartheid in South Africa. But sanctions work best against leaders who have the interest of their country and people at heart, because sanctions hurt the people in the country more than the leaders. The problem is that sanctions are most often imposed against regimes that have only their own interest and the retention of power at heart. Saddam was the perfect example. On Monday, December 3rd, Cheney and I testified on Desert Shield before the Senate Armed Services Committee, a fairly tough sell since Sam Nunn, the chairman, opposed going to war over Kuwait without giving sanctions a hard ride. I reviewed the progress of the coalition buildup, and I gave a cold, hard appraisal of what we faced. Iraq was the fourth largest military power in the world. Also, hanging like a specter over the desert, was the Iraqi biological arsenal and Saddam's feverish drive for nuclear capability. If war came, I had no intention of letting anyone in that committee think it was going to be a cakewalk. We hit some bumps on the road to readiness. Mail began clogging the arteries of war. As we approached Christmas, letters and packages to the troops swamped the military postal system. The letters sent by school kids were touching, but came in sufficient volume to sink a troop transport. The deluge reached a point where every day we were filling 3 and 4 C-5 Galaxies, those flying warehouses, just to accommodate mail and gifts to the troops. American civilians were rallying around the troops as though they wanted to make up for the neglect during the Vietnam years. The explosion of yellow ribbons on trees, homes, jackets, and blouses recalled a national unity not felt since World War II. Dick Cheney and I went to Riyadh on December 19th to size up the state of readiness and report back to President Bush. After the massing we had witnessed of planes, tanks, artillery, armored vehicles, ammo dumps, and hundreds of thousands of troops, I found it hard to believe that Saddam, at the last minute, would not fold. If he had any military men on his staff with an ounce of guts or sense, they would have to tell this non-soldier, non-strategist, that his way was madness. On Christmas Eve, immediately upon getting back from Saudi Arabia, Cheney and I flew to Camp David and were taken to rustic Holly Cabin. We talked that night about the controversy raging in Congress over whether to wait for sanctions to work or to go on the offensive. The president listened distractedly. Suddenly his words brought us up short. "I'll prevail," he said, "or I'll be impeached." I interpreted this to mean that he had completely resigned himself to war. If he won, Congress's opinion would not matter, and if he lost, he was prepared to lose the presidency. On November 20th, Democratic Congressman Ron Dellums from California and 44 other members of the House filed suit in federal district court to prevent President Bush from initiating a war against Iraq without a congressional declaration. I myself favored having Congress take a stand. I had witnessed the contortions the government had gone through during Vietnam,